Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, May 17th, 2012. And the number of topics to cover tonight. First of all, here's a topic I did not cover a couple weeks ago through the flurry of misinformation and news, basically blackout, regarding the meeting that took place in Cartagena, Colombia. And of course, all you heard on the U.S. news was the fact that Secret Service men were caught with prostitutes and the whole laundry list of news events that revolved around that. And of course, first of all, I have had the misfortune of being around a lot of these people, security and the CIA people, and in my opinion, I have not met any of them that are just a bunch of pigs. That's the best thing I can say about them. None of those people should even have jobs. None of that should even exist. But at any rate, that being as it is, the real story, and this is the story that was aired internationally, not in the United States, a little bit in Canada, but the fact that the Latin American countries have had it with the United States and their close buddy Canada, trying to run all the affairs of Latin America. And so basically, Obama, who showed up and, of course, was shunned, I guess that's putting it mildly, the Latin American states have finally come to grips with this issue, and they said that next year at the meeting, Cuba will be included, in spite of the fact that the United States has managed to keep Cuba excluded. Cuba is a dominant power in Latin America. The Latin American countries send their people there to be educated, especially in the areas of medicine, dentistry, and related fields. Cuba is an international leader in Latin America, also in terms of policy, also in terms of dealing with the United States. And of course, the countries are joining together in the criticism of U.S. foreign policy, which for 50 plus years, really 50 plus years easily, has been a policy of just absurdity in the way they deal with the Latin American countries. And this country right now is paying the price in many ways for that. But basically, when you have a block that large of countries putting the American government on notice that it simply doesn't count anymore, the Monroe Doctrine has always provided that the U.S. should protect the Western Hemisphere as part of its foreign policy, but all it has managed to do is abscond with the resources. Interestingly enough, some of the international trade agreements are coming in and actually coming into effect here within the next number of weeks. Of course, we'll see how much effect that has on international trade. You can already see it in fruit products coming into the country from some of those countries. Also driving up food prices in those countries, but of course the common people in those countries and their governments, their corrupt governments in those countries, and the group of political entities and corporations that revolve around those corrupt governments are all profiteering from this. They think it's great, but what does it do for the average person on the street? Then literally on the street in those countries, it drives them down much farther than they already were. But it's interesting to see the governments, which are basically corrupt, supporting the policy of including Cuba in Latin American policy. It's a subject whose time has come. And what was Cuba's crime to the world? Well, they threw out the CIA and the mob and a bunch of Cossack hotel owners and who all fled to South Florida and still, through boisterous, verbose action, try and control American policy in Latin America. But that's coming to an end. So at any rate, it's a topic I didn't cover. You won't find much on that in the news in the United States. Here's another issue that has been going on for some time. In Minnesota, a club is being sued. I guess he's like the head of a club, a buying club, and one of the things that they buy is unpasteurized raw milk. And he's being sued for illegal distribution of basically dangerous goods. And the people are rallying around this. 3 days ago, the trial was postponed for a week. And I think that's interesting, given the public reaction to this, where people are simply trying to get decent food for their families and also having a choice of having the kind of food for their families, the kind of food that they want to provide for their families. But that trial has been postponed until next week, something that I will be covering. And one of the topics I've been covering, of course, for weeks is the corn sale, where I'm providing a non-GMO original dent corn seed to the public. And so this has been distributed far and wide, and hopefully will be one of the nails in the coffin of the Monsantos, Cargills, and all of the rest of the seed companies out there that are trying to limit the public's access to good, real food. So at any rate, that's something that I'm trying to do my part. But I want to mention something also, and this is becoming more and more clear, that, for example, I got an email, I just want to insert one of my own comments here, and this is something that I've believed for a long time. I am not myself particularly a beer drinker. But there's something that I'm seeing happening in the American public, and I'm trying to detect where it's coming from. And I'm hypothesizing that something besides alcohol is being placed in beer, the American-made beers. And it's along the lines of either sterilization or immunization of the basically sexual aspects of people, of men, possibly women. As something that I'm looking into. And I'm finding support for that, although I can't say definitively yet that that is happening. But what I'm finding is that food, especially grains, here's the point, grains are being infiltrated by the GMO companies. And I got an email this week from a listener, and I want to go through this particular email because it's very interesting. This is, of course, in response to my distribution of the dent corn seed. This was originally published in May of 2011, about a year ago, in Health, Food News, and Big Pharma. And so it's the title here, The Children of the Corn, GMO Sterility and Spermicides. The point of this quite lengthy article is that the USDA has funded projects to develop genetically modified corn that sterilizes people. And there are companies that have projects going funded by the U.S. government, and of course the U.S. government would be the purchaser in many of these contracts for the end product. But the point is, they're thinking, isn't it good that we could feed sterility chemicals right in the grain, genetically modified in the grain, in the kernels of grain, in this case corn. And then, for example, corn is a staple in Mexico and a lot of countries of the world. Corn is actually a staple, as I've said before. It's the third most important grain in the world, followed by, or led by rice and wheat, in front of corn. But in a lot of places, if you look locally, corn is a far more important grain than rice and wheat, much more available to the local people. So the point is that they can genetically add sterility chemicals right into the grain, the genetics of the grain, so it grows in the grain. And so some of these projects are coming to fruition. These spermicides are hidden in GMO corn, the article says, provided to starving third world populations through the generosity of the Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, Kofi Annan's AGRA, Armeni, and Profound. Isn't GM technology directed beyond third world countries, but at all countries in the world, and first and most heavily in the United States? Is there a relationship, I'm reading from the article now, is there a relationship since the introduction of GM crops in the U.S. to how steeply birth rates in the U.S. have fallen? And this is something I've talked about before, that the birth rate of the people who are residents of the United States, the birth rate is dropping dramatically. However, the population of the United States is growing by leaps and bounds, probably in the last 10 years by 100 million, basically in the form of illegal aliens and babies under the age of 5. What the first thing they do when they come here is have babies, babies, babies. And so, at any rate, this is an article I wanted to talk about. I don't have time to cover a lot of this particular article, but I wanted to include it. Here are some other companies. It talks about Northrop King, Novartis, which was formerly Ceva, Mycogen. These are some of the hybrid companies. But at any rate, something that's very important to understand, that much of the food today, when you go to the grocery store, whether it's in boxes, whether it's processed food, you look up and down the aisles of your average grocery store today and you see packaged goods. People 100 years ago would wonder, what is in these boxes? What is in the box? You know, they wouldn't recognize it as food. Many people today would not recognize real food if they saw it on the shelf, nor would they know what to do with it. If they didn't open a box and read the directions, they wouldn't know how to prepare real food. So that's very interesting. But at any rate, it's very clear that food and the genetic strains of food are being basically altered. I think once before I talked about the codes that come in on vegetables and fruits when they come into this country with labels. There's a 4 or 5 digit code. You can look those codes up to see what kind of food you're buying, whether they're processed foods, whether they're genetically modified, whether they have had chemicals, whether they're organic. And then, of course, there's questions regarding what organic really means when it comes in from a foreign country. Okay, so enough of that. Just a quick update. The corn seed on my webpage is continuing to sell, and we are now at the 17th of May. Planting in the northern states is happening right now. A lot of people already have corn in the ground, but it's not too late to plant up until the end of May. This is 110-day corn, and you can still plant it by the end of May and have a good crop, which would end in early September. That's when the plants start to dry out. A lot of people are actually getting two crops. Somebody pointed out that early, like, for example, farmers with early crops, whether they're vegetables, could be an early crop of wheat, can still plant this corn and have it still produce. In many of the states of the United States, they can still plant up into June and still have a very successful crop. So as a result of that information, the corn seed sale will continue up into at least June. So I just wanted to make sure people know that. Last week I announced that I'm reintroducing flax seed, the sale of flax seed, on my webpage. And I was rather busy this past week, so I didn't get it posted, but I promise that will be posted within the next, let's say, 24 hours. And so the reason I took it off the page before was because of shipping issues, and those have all been resolved now to have reasonable shipping rates. So you pay a reasonable rate. It's right in the cost of the items on the web page. And also I'm introducing, along with that, some new products, flax-related products. So it's really something. Now, here's something also regarding the corn and the flax. You could eat the corn that I'm sending you, but it would be a very expensive taco. But the point is that now you can start to grow your own long-term survival food. Flax is one of those seeds that you can plant it. It'll grow, and you can produce your own flax seed. Now, I doubt if people are going to be doing this on a very large scale, but the point is that you can grow a tremendous amount of your own survival food. And I ask this question to people. They say, "Am I prepared? We've gotten our freeze-dried or dehydrated foods. We've gotten stored up grains, we've got sprouts, we've done other things." And then they ask, what can they do? And I said, have you prepared for long term? And they I usually get a blank stare or kind of silence. It's like nobody expects the disaster, if it comes, to be long term. Everybody thinks, well, 6 months is plenty, or if they got a year, that's really a lot. Oh, they can't imagine something being more than a year and you would have to take care of yourself because by then everything will be back to normal. Well, no. There could be situations in which you are on your own and it's going to be permanent. In fact, anybody who thinks in lesser terms is only fooling themselves. You could look into the Bible, the old books, the old texts. They all talk about the same thing. I always like that line that the rich man would trade his entire fortune for the head of a donkey to make soup for his family. That's a pretty striking statement, but it's in the Old Testament, and it's something that they're trying to make people realize in the future that these things can happen where you're just on your own. Flax is the survival food of the Old Testament. So at any rate, that's going to be available again, and so I suggest that people get that. The other thing is this is something you would be using now and every day. Every day you should be taking flax. Every day you should be grinding your own corn. Every day you should be living, and I always tell people, live on many levels. And live on your, if you have a good job, everything's going well. If, say, you're retired, say you're have a meager income and you're doing kind of okay, I don't care what's going on. I don't care if you're the head of CEO of Facebook and you have billions and billions of dollars at your disposal. I don't care who you are. If the infrastructure goes down, you're all going to be in the same boat. I don't care how much money you think you've got. You're not going to be able to buy food because the people that have food are going to keep it for themselves. So it's very simple. No matter who you are, you're going to, at some point, possibly have to take care of yourself. That means clean water and food. So flax is a food that you can eat. You can live on it. It has enough nutrients, et cetera, that you can actually live on it for long periods of time. So at any rate, that'll be on the webpage, jmccsci.com. Okay, enough of that. It's just something that I feel very strongly about. And it's a way for you to get away from the food that is tainted with genetically modified chemicals and who knows what all is in that food. Then you go to the grocery store. Don't be fooled by the label organic. That just means that it passed some qualifications to be organic. That does not mean that it's non-hybrid. It doesn't really tell you anything about the genetics of that plant. Okay, let's see. Oh, this is something. A couple weeks ago, I started talking about cancer and the responses. I asked people if you have any response regarding cancer, or cancer treatments, alternative cancer treatments, or where you can come about these, to please send in information. What I got was a very long, I got a lot of response, let's put it that way. A lot of these revolved around the same topics, including a whole laundry list, and it seems that some of the best ones are the least expensive. But there's something that all of the sources all say. It's one thing that they all say. They say, if you take chemo, which is the standard bloodletting technique used by what would you call modern medicine in the pharmaceutical companies, if you take chemo, it will destroy your immune system and natural remedies will not work. That's why they want to get people in there. You got to go to chemo. You got to get under the knife. You got to do A, B, C, and you got to do it right away, because they know that if you have an inkling of looking around and you actually start looking around for other solutions, you're going to come across them easily on the internet, on YouTube, and you may not be back in the door for their chemotherapy. This is a lot of money per patient, and especially, of course, the cancer can be in some of the older people who are with Medicare and Medicaid, and that will pay only for chemo. It will not pay for alternative medications or alternative procedures. So at any rate, I'm not a doctor. I'm not trying to tell you what to do, but I'm telling you to research this before you start letting somebody pour deadly poisonous drugs in your body, telling you that they're going to cure you. Just remember that that's an industry. It's a business. They're there to make money. And unless you go in and allow them to pour poison into your body, there are alternatives. And a lot of people, more and more people every day, are saying no to chemo and saying yes to alternatives. And one of the logistics of this is that people, the chemo probably kills as many people as cancer kills. So if you die, remember, I never have heard anybody statistically be classified as dying from chemo. No, you died from cancer. That's the official report from the American Medical Association. Never in the history of cancer treatment has anybody died from chemo. It's always been from cancer. That probably tells you something right there. But we know, I had an aunt and an uncle and a cousin all that died from chemo treatments. They died from that long before they would have ever died from cancer. So at any rate, that's something I probably won't come back to that topic. It's a very touchy topic because the American Medical Association is very militant about getting you in there and telling sources that they can't talk about this, they can't reach this topic. So at any rate, as I say, I'm not telling you to do anything or not do anything. I'm just telling you to research, find out the alternatives, and also just decide what you want to do with your body and make that choice. This coming Sunday, there is going to be a solar eclipse that covers the country. It's going to start in China. So I know there's people in China listening to this show in the early morning. And so at sunrise in China, this starts. And what's going to happen is the moon is going to move between Earth and the sun and cause an eclipse. It's going to be a total solar eclipse. Now, the point is that the moon is rather distant in its orbit around Earth. So instead of being a total eclipse, this is going to be a ringed or annular eclipse in which a little portion of the sun will be visible as a ring, as when, and also now for people in the United States, I believe this begins in Oregon, the state of Oregon, and I'm not going to give a lot of data on this show. You can find this information on the internet, exactly what time to look if you're in the west and southwestern United States. It's going to end in Texas, as far as the United States is concerned, late in the afternoon or evening. And I believe the evening times, if I'm not mistaken, will be around 6 p.m. on Sunday in Oregon, where this will start to become visible. So at any rate, look for this, and remember, do not look at the sun. This is an eclipse for which you will need special equipment or welder's glasses or some form of eye protection. Don't use telescopes, don't use binoculars, don't look directly at the sun. And there again, look up and understand what kind of equipment you really need to look at this eclipse. So some people are very excited about this. I've always thought it would be real interesting with the thousands and thousands, tens of thousands, possibly millions of people looking at these events. And of course, this is Sunday and there's no way to predict. But what if a big comet came streaking in towards the sun, and the whole world was able to see one of these big comets come in and discharge right at the sun and then watch a major league solar flare come off the sun? And millions of people would be able to see this for themselves. I think it would be just a tremendous, tremendous thing for the world to see. But at any rate, I don't know if there's any comets coming in. I just think it would be interesting. So, but I'm sure a lot of people will be watching that. Once again, don't look directly at this with your naked eye. Don't look through binoculars or telescopes directly, unless you have the proper equipment and filters. There again, look at the information available to the public on the type of information or the type of equipment that you would need to see this. Okay, I'm going to be talking, my main science topic tonight, I will be talking about winds. Right now there's severe weather all around the world. And I'm just going to list a few of these that are in the United States. Right now, there are no less than 5 himicanes circling on the U.S. mainland right now. A himicane is a term I defined a long time ago. It's in my weather book. A himicane is a hurricane, but over land. So it's a little play on words. Right now, there are no fewer than 5 of them in the United States. One is centered on the California-Nevada-Oregon border, up in that corner, northeast corner of California. Another one is in eastern Colorado, a very big himicane, a very beautiful, from a satellite point of view, from a picture, from the people on the ground who are experiencing the winds. I'm sure it's not so beautiful, but eastern Colorado is the location of one of the himicanes. Minnesota, Wisconsin, experiencing consistent, for about a week now, long, very heavy winds. Basically, they feel like straight-line winds, but they're coming up over the top of these himicanes that are basically circling through the lower states, driving very powerful southerly and southwesterly straight line winds. And a fourth weather system just passed through the South Carolina, North Carolina region, and a fifth one in southeast Alaska, a big cyclonic himicane. There are a tremendous amount of tropical storm activity, most of it over the oceans at this time. A blast of big storms just rolled off the western tip of Africa, that hip of Africa that is at about, it's about 8 degrees northern latitude. And these storms are moving west and slightly south, so pointing somewhere towards South America. Typically, those storms, as we head into the very beginning of the hurricane season, typically those storms would be rolling off that point of Africa and moving slightly northerly as they move west across the Atlantic Ocean, but they, through past years, they seem to be tracking much farther south. And as I said, the Malaysia area, South China Sea, just being blasted with severe weather. So we've had a lot of severe weather. The sun has been very active over past days. We've had a series of mega explosions on the sun, a number of them pointed away from Earth, but the solar wind conditions at Earth are quite variable, and today we were hit with kind of a wall of protons coming off the sun in the solar wind. This actually arrived at Earth, planet Earth, today. So a lot of very, let's call it variable solar wind and solar system conditions attributing the weather on Earth attributable to those rapidly changing solar conditions. That's something that I printed in my weather book. And slowly but surely, the scientific community started to wake up that, yes, it's not just the solar conditions. We can be in very powerful solar wind conditions, and if they're constant, it really doesn't bother us. But as soon as those rapid changes start to occur, that's when Earth weather can get, let's say, violent. Okay, here's a story that I reported on, probably last month or a couple months ago, possibly even now. This is reemerging, where scientists are saying that billions and billions of rogue planets are roaming all over the galaxy, and they could provide the galaxy with missing mass that would make their basically illogical galactic models work. Let me go back to, like, when I was at Cornell University. The standard belief at that time was that galaxies formed with everything had to begin with a rotating dust cloud. But the question was, how do the spiral arms form in the galaxy? Well, to have that happen, you needed some kind of outside interaction. So then they said, okay, well, possibly a major interaction between galaxies would start the rotational waves moving in the galactic arms, and this would cause the stars to collapse, creating the galactic arms. And these theories never, ever worked, because they simply didn't explain the most basic properties of spiral galaxies, which is the symmetry. How did these gravitational or alleged gravitational interactions happen and cause the tremendous symmetry in galaxies that might be 50 or 100 billion light years across? A tremendous distance between objects on one side of the galaxy and the other, and no rhyme or reason why the structure in one arm should be exactly the same structure in the other arm. And this is consistent across all galaxies. You might find one galaxy, okay, you could explain one, but billions of galaxies with this tremendous symmetry cannot be explained by that kind of model. And so then another little problem arose. As they looked at the light, the redshift in the coming from the stars and the arms, the red shifts and the blue shifts, the stars moving away in one arm and the red shifts moving towards, or the stars moving away from us in one arm causing a red shift, the stars in the other arm moving towards us causing a blue shift, these didn't match up with Newtonian or Keplerian dynamics. In other words, Newton's gravitational laws didn't seem to be upheld. The only way they could possibly be upheld is if you decided to place ad hoc, or by deciding that there should be a tremendous amount of mass circling in the mid-region of the galaxy. This would make your rotational curves come out correctly, but then you had another little problem. How did this tremendous amount of mass become very evenly distributed throughout the galaxy in the mid-arm regions? And then it turned out that there was a lot, not just a little bit, but a lot more hundreds of thousands of times more matter circling the nucleus than was in the nucleus. How does this happen? How do you have the big stuff orbiting the little stuff? The Band-Aid theories just got thicker and thicker and thicker, but they're still, this is 2012, they are still trying to talk about the missing mass, putting a Band-Aid on a theory that never worked in the first place. But see, this is what happens in astronomy. People get PhDs, that's what their professor said, that's what they have to say to keep the funding going and to keep the telescope time moving, to keep the funding moving into their bin. So at any rate, here we are in 2012, and you have astronomers trying to rationalize billions of rogue planets flying around the galaxy. But remember, they're just flying around the galaxy. They never come in and bother anything in here in the solar system, but there's billions and billions of them. Remember, they've never seen one of these rogue billions and billions of planets out there. They've never detected one. They don't know where to look for one, and even if they were out there, they don't have equipment that could find them. But yet, this is published in the respected peer-reviewed astrophysics and astronomical journals. That's why, by the way, I don't have anything to do with them. Early in my career, I published in astrophysics and space science journals, only to find out that it's a big political system, and they don't want to have anything to do with any new ideas. Don't come along here with any new ideas, especially if it has to do with a new idea about comets. Don't upset the Big Bang apple cart. Okay, enough of that. Let me see. Here's a note on seeds that I was trying to insert a couple of times. It's my own little experiment. For many, many years, I had been saving seeds from heirloom seeds, from other seed sources. And I would also save seeds from the packages that I would buy. And, of course, I always kept those separate. But always under the same good storage conditions. What I found is the seeds that you buy in the store won't propagate the next year or the next year or the next year. It's like they have a little time bomb in there, and the seeds will only grow for one season. So that's why they tell you always get fresh seeds. Well, that's a good idea, but if you know how to store seeds, good seeds will store for a very long time. When some of the chambers of the pyramid were opened, this is in recent history, these are the ancient pyramids. The grains that were in and stored in the pyramid still were able to sprout. So this is probably, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years later. They were kept dry, away from light. Those are the conditions for storing seeds. Some people put them in the nitrogen atmosphere. I don't know if that's that good an idea. I don't know if that's been proven to be a good way to store seeds. But if you keep them dry, very dry, and if you keep them away from light, those are the two things that destroy seeds. But as I'm talking about this, so I have kept seeds for in some cases decades, which were hybrid, they were not non-hybrid. They were heirloom seeds from good sources. Those seeds sprout. You still have a high percentage of them that sprout. But the other seeds, the ones that I buy in the packages, a year or two later, none of them sprout. So it's just something, maybe there's somebody out there that can give me some feedback along these same lines. Let's see. Here's a topic. Yeah, I've got some notes that I wanted to talk about on the same vein of billions and billions of rogue planets out there. Here's an article that just came out this past week, and I understand this is not a new new concept, but okay, a couple years ago, the planet Pluto was minimized. It was taken off the planetary list of planets, so we all of a sudden had 8 planets. The reason that was done, it was a very political move by some astronomers, who central core group of astronomers, who did not want the public to grab onto the idea that all of a sudden now there are 40 or 50 planets. They're discovering these objects, they're called Kuiper Belt objects, they're Pluto-sized objects in the far reaches of the solar system. Okay, well, recently there have been astronomers who claim that some of those orbits are strange, and they're very elliptical. Well, they're saying that elliptical orbits should not occur in a solar system that forms from a collapsing cloud of dust and gas. They should all be nice circular orbits. So then they hypothesize some rogue planet out there in the far reaches of the solar system, which are creating disturbances in the orbits of these objects, and therefore creates elongates their orbits into long ellipses. The planet Sedna, or I would call it a planet, has a very elliptical orbit. So this is not consistent with a solar system that formed all from one big rotating cloud of gas and dust. So now they're trying to hypothesize a planet. Well, isn't that interesting? Now, astronomers get to hypothesize planets out there, but they have very limited properties. That it's way out there, it's not something that could affect Earth or the inner solar system. It's something that is way out there and only affects the orbits of these particular outer planets. And I still would call the Kuiper objects planets because they literally are. My definition of a planet is something that is round. It's had enough formation, heat of formation, to cause it to be in a molten state, and therefore self-gravity has pulled it together into a sphere-type shape. Okay, so given that, we, in my opinion, have about 40 planets right now. These scientists are hypothesizing a newer, or not a necessarily newer, but a large planet out there, Neptune size, in the far, far reaches of the solar system, far beyond Pluto. So number one, I find it's interesting that standard astronomy can hypothesize new planets all they want. They give them all of these correct, politically correct properties, so that they're not dangerous to anybody in the solar system, but they seem to need these to explain why planets don't follow the rules. This is just another case. They need to invent something. Can they find this object? Not with equipment that is available today. And when other astronomers were asked, I like this in the article I saw, they gave it about a 1 in 100 chance. That's my personal number there. But there was not a lot of wide acceptance of this concept. But I never heard any of the astronomers say, I don't think so, because if we talk about this, then we have to start talking about planet X type objects. And that's exactly what they're actually claiming. So the astronomers, as I said, can paint a pretty picture for their own particular use, because the discoveries that they're actually discovering, the Kuiper Belt objects, don't fit the plan that they have, so they need some kind of band-aid. But the other astronomers don't criticize in that vein. They just say, well, it'll be a long time until we can discover this planet, etc., and they let it go. So astronomers are not, they're a little bit critical, but only in a politically correct sense. That's the point I want to make of their own theories. But it's, as I said, they can theorize rogue planets out there, but you and I can't. You and I can't talk about them. If you and I talk about them, we're crackpots. If astronomers talk about them, that's acceptable theory. if you see what I mean. Okay, I'm going to switch and talk about, let me see if I've covered the, I covered the solar eclipse. Okay, the main science topic tonight, I'm going to deal with winds. We have had a lot of wind in various places around the country, much in excess of normal lately. And if you haven't particularly experienced the wind situation, then you're one of the rare commodities out there. It has been extremely windy and not the usual kind of winds. Sure, in the springtime, in April, early May, we can get a windy day or two, just like we can in the fall. But we have had days and weeks of consistent high winds. We've had a tremendous amount of severe weather this particular spring, more so than normal. So exactly what is going on, I'm not exactly sure. But I want to talk a little bit also about historically, the ancients talked about what they called the devil winds. These were the winds that preceded and occurred during the time of passages of comets through the solar system, and they are very, very specific. If you look at the Mayans, if you look at the Hopi, if you look at the Southwest American legends of the Phoenix, if you look at the Chinese legends of the dragon, if you look at any of the other legends that come from around the world, the one thing they talk about is that the Colburn talks about it. The one thing they talk about is that the winds start blowing. The winds start blowing harder and harder, and it becomes, it's kind of like a forewarning, let me put it that way. So I'm not at this point saying that there's anything coming into the solar system. I'm not sure. I don't have any positive information on that, but we do and have had many comets coming into the solar system from the south. I will say this. I've been watching for these closely in SOHO, and the stereo data that comes, these are the satellites that monitor the sun's activity. And recently, those satellites have been shut down quite regularly, especially around the time of severe solar activity. A lot of missing data. And so I'm not sure what that's all about. Is that coincidence? Is somebody playing with the data? They know too many people are looking at the sun through these satellites, through the data that comes on the internet. The people are monitoring the sun, and so they can't get away with too much, so they're actually just taking away the feed. I'm not sure exactly. I wish we had better solar monitoring equipment out there where the public had access and we could simply bypass the standard government scientists, because they have a long, grandiose history of shutting down these systems when something is going on. Not the least of which was last September. If you remember, I was on the beginning of that whole series of comets that came in for about, 4 or 5 months. We had weekly comets coming in from the south. And it started in late September, and that was one weekend when NASA shut down the feed. They blocked all the information from this large comet that came in and kicked off those solar flares. And then all the apologists were out there, all of the government-supported apologists, trying to smooth it over and just say, no, that was just coincidence. And so literally, I have hundreds and hundreds. My webpage has some of these listed, some of the good ones, not all of them. There's just too many to list. This goes back since the SOHO satellite was first launched. Comets coming in mainly from the south and interacting with the sun and causing solar flares. Now let me make it perfectly clear. Not all solar flares are caused by comets. The sun has a lot of solar flare activity all by itself. So at any rate, the sun can have a tremendous amount of surface activity by itself. But consistently, when the large comets come in near the sun, you can see that spark plug Many times you see the solar, a number of weeks ago, we saw the tornado lift off the sun, go directly out to the comet, and then within minutes, boom, a major solar flare comes off that same portal out of the sun. All very clear data to anybody that would look at that, and that it's very clear. How does this affect wind on planet Earth? Well, the solar wind, like I said before, it's like a wind of charged particles coming from the sun. It can be very weak, it can be very strong, but when the changes occur in that wind, remember that the solar wind also carries a magnetic field, it's kind of like a fire hose of charged particles hitting Earth. And when the changes occur, that's when a lot of dynamic responses occur in Earth's magnetic field, in the geomagnetic field, in the external magnetic field that protects Earth. And that's when a lot of the effects occur that go all the way down to the troposphere and drive our weather systems, the wind systems. My weather book encourage people to get the weather book to learn more about this. The weather book defines 17 what I call local batteries. They are local plasma batteries caused by plasma conditions around Earth. Each one of them can drive weather systems in a variety of ways. And so it shows how the solar wind interacts with Earth's magnetic field, Earth's plasma shield, and how these solar wind changes can drive electric and magnetic conditions on Earth, driving Earth's weather systems. That's also, by the way, the source of energy that Tesla was using when he was extracting electrical energy from the atmosphere. And by the way, I've talked about this before many times, that Tesla is very much misquoted. There's a movie out that features some of Tesla's work, a Tesla Tower, but they always try and promote that he was trying to distribute power with his Tesla Tower. Well, not really. The whole idea of the Tesla Tower was to extract energy from the ionosphere, and then it would be distributed on a grid system. That's the original Tesla ideal. But when they tore down Tesla's tower, a lot of that got changed. They don't want the public to really understand what he was doing there, that he was extracting energy. Always have this statement. People say, oh no, he was using it to distribute energy. Well, where exactly was he getting the energy to distribute? Westinghouse had purchased his generators. He had no source of energy, no mechanical source of energy. So where exactly was Tesla getting the energy that he was supposed to distribute with his Tesla tower? It's an absurd concept, just like all the other absurd misinformation concepts that are floating around out there. But Tesla was gathering energy, and then it would have been distributed on a high voltage distribution system out to the homes and industries. So at any rate, it's the solar wind, the passing solar wind, and the voltages that are built up as the solar wind comes by. 17 various local electrical batteries, LEBs I call them in the book, build up around Earth, and those interact with one another, with Earth's magnetic field, with the ionosphere, and drive the lower weather systems. All of this energy is coming down, and then it's the energy source that drives our winds. I've been a proponent for a long time of Tesla power, but Tesla power has some problems. It's the direct use of electrical energy coming from the ionosphere. It's very dangerous. If you hook this up to your grid and you have a major solar storm and it overtakes your distribution system, excuse me, you are going to have a serious problem. It could blow up your distribution system and cause a lot of damage. So my current thinking on the use of natural energy is that wind is the best source of natural energy. The only problem is that the current three-blade systems are extremely inefficient. They capture an extremely small percentage of the energy passing in the wind patterns. But if you look at the available wind, if you actually make calculations of the energy in wind on Earth, it could easily, with two things, we save energy by not using as much, and then install real wind generators which are efficient. But unfortunately, this is something I've said all along, the three-blade system was a NASA design. It was implemented, it was put into place, corporations formed around that technology and installed it, but it's a very inefficient, very poor system, and it was always meant to fail. It was meant to be a failure, and people all around the world now are viewing wind power as a failure because of the three-blade system. And my contention is that was always the intention. It was planned obsolescence. It was pushed into the industry, and as with just about everything else in engineering and in science, people go to school, they learn something, they think they've learned, they're the smartest people on the planet, and they go out and implement what they've been taught, never questioning it. There's something I want to point out here, and that is the use in electric cars. There was a movie called The Italian Job. It's a serious kind of thriller. But in that movie, they have some small British-made vehicles that they used were electric-powered. Those vehicles were converted to be completely electric, and they used what are known as wheel motors, electric motors in the wheels of those vehicles. I saw a picture of a Porsche around the 1900s that used exactly the same technology. We should all be driving electric cars. There should be no nuclear, coal, or oil at all. And so, anyway, there's a lot of effort afoot now to reduce and eliminate oil, coal, and nuclear power sources from use in the world today. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.